new paradigm that we need to develop that is beyond the two states or the maintenance of the current regime in Israel. We need to move beyond that. As I usually say, look, forget about the genocide, right? Forget about the killing of children and innocent civilians and the destruction of hospitals, schools, and infrastructure in Gaza. Forget about the famine. Forget about the babies being targeted in the chest, in the brain, and in the testicles, and so on and so forth. Forget about all that. I mean, when the world looks at this current Israeli society, you know, seeing those soldiers videoing themselves killing babies in incubators, when they see that 96% of the society is saying that what the IDF is doing in Gaza is either sufficient or not enough violence. So when the world sees this kind of society, forget about the genocide, like I say. Are we happy to kind of sustain that kind of society moving into the future? Let that society thrive? Let that regime that enabled and indoctrinated and produced the society thrive? I think that's what we need to be focusing on. Rather than recognizing Palestine, we need to recognize what the world has created over the past 7 decades or so.
Yeah, we need to recognize Israel for what it really is.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the original sin that we need to recognize, you know, the Nakba, and even before the Nakba, the first Intifada in 1936 of the Palestinians revolting against the British that enabled the mass migration of Zionists into Palestine. And so all these things that are important to recognize before recognizing this perfunctory statement that everyone is gearing up to provide next month, there needs to be accountability. And I'm glad that, you know, some legal infrastructure somewhere in the world is doing that. You know, the Hend Rajab Foundation is actually looking after all these, you know, soldiers who are enrolling in Gaza, committing a genocide, videoing themselves as they go, and that's how they find out about them. So the barbarism, the level of barbarity with those soldiers, they themselves are actually revealing themselves for those legal institutions. It's just mind-boggling to think how many of those soldiers, how many videos they put on social media, on TikTok, proudly filming themselves committing all these atrocities against babies and children in Gaza. And so, absolutely, there needs to be accountability, not only for the Palestinians, because if the world allows this to happen to the Palestinians in the hands of this genocidal state, then every single state around the world will be emboldened to do the same, because there's no accountability. Everyone can do whatever they want in this, you know, lawless world. So in order to prevent anything like this from happening generally in around the world, we need to achieve accountability. We need to prosecute all these people accused of genocide. We need to enforce the ICC arrest warrants against the war criminals, Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant. I mean, absolutely, all these news corps and the Murdoch media and mainstream media, they're all gradually realizing that what's unfolding in Gaza is beyond the act of genocide. They all agree with that. They all are implicitly in agreement. And therefore, now they're trying to, you know, report some of what's happening in Gaza. You know, all these reporters filmed being massacred and the paramedics following that in a double tap kind of incident. So the news media, they feel that they need to report on that. However, they maintain their stance in support of Zionism and the Zionist regime in Israel, and therefore they continue to support their narrative by hosting their own mouthpieces, you know, in terms of hosting politicians or reporters who are biased heavily to the Zionist narrative. So we are seeing some reporting in the mainstream media about the atrocities and the genocidal campaign in Gaza, but not to the extent that we say we should be comforted with that. It is a continual mouthpiece for the genocide, for the Zionist regime, and eventually, just like what happened in previous genocidal campaigns around the world, the media news outlets will be held accountable one day. Whether that day is soon or later, they will be held accountable, and they probably will be prosecuted for supporting the genocide. Now, what we do in the pro-Palestine solidarity movement, I think we're doing a great work. Now, the impact of what we're doing is very slow, but we are up against a mountain of, you know, accumulated years of indoctrination in the public opinion psyche and in the mainstream media as well. You know, the Zionist lobby and the Israel lobby here in Australia is showing its strength and power, but it's also showing its weakness, you know, the way they're addressing public freedom of speech, academic freedom, and so on and so forth. The more furious and the more outrageous they become in the laws that they try and push on our federal government and state government, they will have tremendous consequences because they're no longer sensical. Centering anti-Semitism, for example, as opposed to racist sentiments against First Nation here, is just outright ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And I borrow the words of Professor Peter Slezak in saying anti-Semitism is absolutely negligible here in this country, but there are those mouthpieces and those elements in our government, unfortunately Zionist elements, that are pushing for that narrative, spreading fear and intimidation, not only in the Australian society, but it's also in the Jewish community. You know, they are being the victim of these Zionist elements in our government. And so whatever we do to push our narrative, whatever we do to combat these decades of indoctrination, I think we're doing a great work in terms of educating the public. Alternative media is the way to go right now. Mainstream media is losing its credibility, not only on Palestine. You know, when it comes to discussing prices of housing, for example, or how the Labour government is behaving or is faring, not many people in the Australian society actually trust mainstream media, let alone the attitude on Palestine. So there is a huge shift in that area because people do not trust mainstream media, because people can see through the atrocity, the genocide, the famine, the killing of babies and children. They can see through all that. But what we need to do as the pro-Palestine movement is to go into those spaces, hold webinars, hold panels, hold educational systems, speak one-on-one to community members, not necessarily politicians. I think personally, lobbying politicians for a change is a losing battle, is a very, very losing battle, because the level of economic benefit and, you know, social benefit that those politicians are getting out of supporting Israel is tremendous, and it's hard to change overnight.
I mean, it makes me think of the Australian mayoral summit that's being held in the Gold Coast, that's being supported by the Combat Anti-Semitism from the States. They're giving people an all-expenses-paid trip junket to the Gold Coast to listen to Zionists on how to combat anti-Semitism in their communities. So, I mean, yeah, we definitely don't have that sort of resources. So we have to approach it from a very different perspective. But what do you make of this institutional co-option, you know, like with Gillian Siegel being made the special envoy and her report being absolutely ludicrous? Not only that, this, like, the recent government's decision to oust the Iranian embassy is ridiculous. I mean, satire doesn't really even pale to reality at this point. What do you make of these sorts of institutional cowardice or...
Absolutely, it is institutional cowardice. It's just outrageous to appoint someone like Gillian Siegel as an envoy for anti-Semitism in Australia, especially because she is the major member or element that is trying to push for conflation of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism being, you know, criticizing Israel as a state, as a foreign state. We are not allowed to criticize a foreign state. That she actually used to be on the board of the Australian-Israel Commerce Chamber. So all these connections that Gillian Siegel as a person has with the state of Israel, with Zionism, is just it's unbelievable. It's mind-boggling that she ends up being the nominee for such a position to combat anti-Semitism. And so pretty much the world is her oyster in that case. She can do whatever she wants to push for a certain definition of anti-Semitism that penalized criticism of Israel, penalized criticism of Zionism as an ideology, conflation Zionism with Judaism, which is a whole thing that we can get into. But it's that engagement that is outright shameful for our government, really, to be appointing such a person. You know, you mentioned that summit that's happening in Queensland. She's in the leadership of that summit, and it's absolutely shameful.
Yeah, well, I mean, in her report, she proposed producing a report card to keep universities accountable to their anti-Semitic pledges. She recommended, amongst other things, to personally audit as the envoy media and make sure that it was suitable to be broadcast.
It's absolutely crazy. And then one should really ask themselves, I mean, why now? Why now? Why isn't this definition, or why isn't this envoy appointed 5 years ago or 6 years ago? Why now? It is precisely because the country that we're trying to criticize, that we're trying to cut ties with, that we're trying to push the government to sanction, is currently engaged in an act of genocide. And so it is precisely now, because Gillian Siegel is trying to give a free hand to this genocidal state to continue doing whatever it wants to the Palestinians without being criticized.
Yeah, absolutely. And to take it back, if we just take a time machine really quickly, if we take a look at what the situation in Gaza was pre-October 7th, just to get an idea of the type of life that people were living, Palestinians were living in Gaza before October 7th.
That's a very good question. I don't know how long you have, but there's a lot to be said in that space. You know, you mentioned that Gaza has been under siege for 17 years. I would argue it's been under siege for longer than that. I mean, even before Oslo Accords were signed in 1993, Gaza has always been separated. You know, the Palestinians in Gaza have always been separated from the Palestinians in the West Bank. You know, Gaza was part of, not before 1967, Gaza was part of Egypt, and West Bank was part of Jordan. I grew up in Gaza, and, you know, it's a funny thing that not many people know about, but my accent is actually different from the Palestinian from Jenin, for example, because they have more of a Jordanian accent, and I have more of a Palestinian accent when I speak Arabic. So it's funny how that separation has been entrenched in the Palestinian society. We have Palestinians in Gaza, Palestinians in East Jerusalem, Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinians in the diaspora, and Palestinians in 1948. We have Palestinians in the refugee camps. So there's so many groups that they've divided us into. And that's why it has been very, very difficult to kind of unite under one narrative. And that's why within the Palestinian community, within all these groups, you have different varying opinions as to what the resolution should be, you know, two states, one state, and so on and so forth. So this is a long answer, but for Gazans, you know, building from the 90s up to the First Intifada and the signing of Oslo, Gaza has always been under that separation, isolation situation away from the outside world. And it certainly became more effective, that siege, after Hamas won the election in 2006, beyond which Israel decided to unilaterally withdraw its settlement because back then, settlements were still present in Gaza, sort of just like what we see in the West Bank right now, you know, checkpoints separating or dividing the strip into four different sections and so on and so forth. The settlements were aligned along the coast. I grew up in Gaza and unable to swim because I was not allowed to go to the beach to learn how to swim and so on and so forth. So the besiegement in Gaza, the sanctions on the Hamas government in Gaza, you know, alongside the collaboration of the Palestinian Authority with, you know, with the CIA, with the Israelis to orchestrate that coup that happened in 2006, which Hamas eventually managed to successfully prevent the PA from taking over Gaza, led to the entrenchment of that siege and the suffering of the Palestinians. Palestinians are unable to move freely across the border. The only border is allowed for personnel is the Rafah border. There are other entrances, Karm Abu Salem, Erez, and others. They're allowed for goods. Israel before October the 7th and for 17 years has put Gaza on a diet, put the population in Gaza on a diet, controlling the amount of calories that go in and out. There's certain types of chocolate that are not allowed to go into Gaza for children to enjoy. There's a certain amount of, you know, fruits and vegetables are only allowed in Gaza. And so that restricting the freedom of movement, you know, restricting the number of calories going into Gaza, you know, every now and then going in and bomb, you know, certain areas, residential areas, and mowing the lawn, as they call it. You know, all these things, they just accumulate in the psyche of the Palestinian who was born in Gaza, grew up in Gaza, and they eventually lead to this rebellion that we witnessed in 2023 in October. As I said, in October the 8th, 2023, October the 7th was inevitable. If you keep blowing into that balloon, eventually it will blow up in your face because, you know, more and more pressure on the Palestinians in Gaza, especially when you look at the, you know, geostrategic transformations that are happening around Gaza at the time, directly led, you know, the resistance to take that decision and, you know, infiltrate and break the siege the way they did in October 7th. As Reverend Stephen Sizer, when I interviewed him, he said, two-state solution is too late. You know, but because of the actions of the Israeli government in the West Bank and in Gaza. And one state solution is too soon. We have a genocide being committed right now. It's hard to bring two people together in one state. And so the main goal right now is to end the genocide.